नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय
action so far is Daiichi Muni has given up his body. By the yogic process, by being absorbed in trance, he wasn't even affected by the separation between the soul and the body. So then 13. Thereafter, King Indra very firmly took up the thunderbolt manufactured by Vishwakarma from the bones of Daiichi. Charged with the exalted power of Daiichi Muni and enlightened by the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Indra rode on the back of his carrier, Airavata, surrounded by all the demigods, while all the great sages offered him praise. Thus he shone very beautifully, pleasing the three worlds as he rode off to kill Ritrasura. Well, there he is, now he's all set. It says here the weapon was charged by the exalted power of Daiichi Mune Shakti Dihi, Siktaha. How is it charged by the exalted power of Daiichi? What's the power? Who remembers? What's special about these bones? They went and they're making this weapon out of the bones of Daiichi Muni. Why are his bones better than anybody else's bones? Understand? Well, we don't know that his body burned up, actually, because they got the bones. Yeah, but what made... But yeah, that's true. But there's all kinds of, let's say there are all kinds of sages that can have that power. But Daiichi had something especially. Nobody remembers. Boy, we're losing our narrative sense here. You can't sit down and tell the story over the campfire if you don't remember the sequence. It's hard because we do one verse at a time. We forget there's a storyline. The story is, because we heard the whole story, Prabhupada gave it in a purport, that Daiichi had already learned the same Narayana Kavacha shield and was very powerful, protected his body already. And so because of his having that shield, he was potent. And we'd already heard a story of someone else whose dead body had knocked the king of the Gandharva's airplane out of the sky. It was a hazard to navigation. There was some other sage that had used the Narayana Kavacha shield, and when he had died, his dead body was laying there, and Chitrarath, who's the king of the Gandharvas, was flying by in his airplane, had been knocked off course because he hit the force from this Narayana Kavacha shield. So anyway, that's why. But then it says also, Bhagavat Tejasa Panditaha was also endowed with special Bhagavat Teja. You know, it's Bhagavat Teja. Anybody recognize these words? Teja? Huh? Power. Yeah, there's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita. I am the power of all powerful people. Page of pages. Bhagavad Teja, the power of. Teja means power, radiance. Bhagavad Teja. That's. And then Indra wrote on the back of his carrier, Airavata. What species of creature is Airavata? The Indra rides. Oh, yeah, it's an elephant. Right. Special elephant. Where did that elephant come from? It was produced in an interesting way. Where? Yeah, that's right. It was one of the things that came out of the ocean. Give my God, spoons churned. Okay. Let's go on. Text 15. My dear King Parikshit, this is Sukadeva Goswami still speaking. My dear King Parikshit, as Rudra, being very angry at Antaka, that is to say, Yamaraj, another name of Yamaraj is Antaka, had formally run toward Antaka to kill him. Indra angrily and with great force attacked Vritrasura, who was surrounded by the leaders of the demoniac armies. So we have two heroes here. One is Indra with his special weapon made from the bones of Darichi, surrounded by the demigods. And also great sages are coming along, you know, offering praises, throwing down flowers and so on. And on the other side, you have to see this on the wide screen, you know, with a good sound system. It's for all movie people. Just think of the day when we got the technology that produced these epics. Huh? No more Dick Tracy. Okay. So then on the other side, here comes Vritrasura. So there are two armies of clashing. So now today's text here, text 16. Say after me. Thereafter, at the end of such a yuga and the beginning of Treta Yuga, a fierce battle took place between the demigods and the demons on the bank of the Narmada. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Herein, the Narmada does not mean the Narmada River in India. The five sacred rivers in India, Ganga, Jamuna, Narmada, Kaveri, and Krishna, are all celestial. Like the Ganges River, the Narmada River also flows in the higher planetary systems. The battle between the demigods and the demons took place in the higher planets. The words Pratame Yuge means in the beginning of the first millennium. That is to say, in the beginning of the Vaidasvata Manvantara. In one day in Brahma, there are 14 Manus who each live for 71 millenniums. The four Yugas, Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali, constitute one millennium. We are presently in the Manvantara of Vaivasvata Manu, who is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Puktavan Aham Adhyayam Vivasvan Manave Prav. We are now in the 28th millennium of Vaivasvata Manu, but this fight took place in the beginning of Vaivasvata Manu's first millennium. One can historically calculate how long ago the battle took place. Since each millennium consists of 4 million
300,000 years, and we are now in the 28th millennium. Some 120,400,000 years have passed since the battle took place on the bank of the river Narmada. Okay. Tataha suranam asurai prana parama dharunaha. So it's a very fearful, fierce battle, big battle, Rana, took place, it says here, Treta Mukhe, at the head of the Treta Yuga. In the first Yuga here means Dharasvatamandhara. Okay. The first thing he says, first, this deal with two things, is place and time that's being discussed here. So this is a radically different version of the universe, both in terms of place and time. Well, the first thing is this is identified as the Narmada River, but not the Narmada River in India, he says very clearly here. So you'll find many things are said to take place on the bank of the Ganges, the Jamuna, the Krishna, the Narmada, what's the other one, Kaveri. These are five sacred rivers, all of which can be found flowing in India. But they don't just flow in India, they also flow in the heavenly planets. The Ganges, we know how it descends to Earth from the heavenly planets. In fact, there's quite an arrangement for its descent, including interplanetary tankers that carry it on regular distribution routes to all the different planetary systems. Anyway, these rivers are existing on higher planets, and that's where the battle took place. Now, a mundane scholar reading this, they say, oh, here's an account of two little tribes. One, a group of invading Aryans, people who call themselves Aryans, came in from up in the Caucasian regions and swooped down. Somehow those Aryans got it into their heads. So is the Aryan invasion theory, you know, that they say the Aryans were this group of people who are abnormally aggressive. For some reason, left their original home, which they speculate was sometime in the north of the Caspian Sea or somewhere in the Caucasian regions. Okay. And they came down, some of them went south into India, and others went west into Europe. And as they separated, they had a common language and a common set of beliefs. And then they split up and migrated into different groups. And their language over the course of time begins to evolve and change. And their beliefs begin to evolve and change. So, altogether, the languages that derive from this original language that they spoke are called the Indo-European languages. And the stories that they told are called Indo-European mythology. They use this word mythology. And So according to this picture, there is, for example, an original language. They call it the Proto-Indo-European language. They call it the, since all of this speculative work, historical work, was done by Germans, the original language is called Ursprache, in German. You know German? Ur means original. Ursprache, original speech, original language. And from this study, when the discovery of Sanskrit and Panini was there, there was born in the 19th century the science of philology. Philology is the historical science of tracing back languages and how they change and grow and develop. So these Germans went to town. They knew Latin, they knew Greek. Everybody in those days knew Latin and Greek. If you were an educated man, you had to know Latin and Greek. And all of a sudden they discovered Sanskrit. Then they realized that Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit, they're somehow or other related. And how are they related? Then they discovered German was related and French was related, and they feel like there's this whole family of languages and there was common characteristics, and then they began to speculate how one changed into another, and then they found laws of linguistic sound changes. Certain laws, and they found, so from all this job of incredible mental speculation and effort, when everything seemed to click into place, they came up with a picture of this original Ursprache. Now when you see words, and if you look in the dictionary, you have a dictionary that tells you derivation of the angle of words. They'll give you the English word, then you'll give you an old French or an old Norse or a Latin. Then they'll give you maybe a Sanskrit. And then the last word will have an asterisk in front of it. That asterisk means this word is from the hypothetical Indo-European Ursprache. The asterisk means it is not attested. That is to say, no one has ever seen it written down. Its existence is purely derived by historical speculation. Right. So anyway, according to this picture, you see there was this original language, and from it all these other languages came out, including Sanskrit. So Sanskrit is one of the Indo-European languages. You know, you get Sanskrit, and then from Sanskrit you get Hindi, Bengali. Just like from another branch you get Greek, or you get Latin, and then from Latin you get the Romance languages. They're called Romance languages because they're derived from Roman language or Latin, not because, you know, French is romantic. French, Italian, Spanish, these are the Romance languages. They derive like that. You get English in there, which is actually comes from another branch, which is Old Norse and German and all this other. There's a whole other, you know, family branching out. So they put this whole picture together. This is what happened. By expect big labor of 19th century, you know, German philologists, big discoveries, and it was really all set off by the discovery of Sanskrit. So Sanskrit does not have pride of place. This every academic you meet, this is the picture they have in their mind. This is like established as firm historical fact. For 1 year, I took a Sanskrit course. At the University of Pennsylvania. And their approach to Sanskrit is to teach it as part, as one component in this whole picture. In other words, it's for people who are studying philology.
So they all have to know some Sanskrit, some Latin, some Greek, and so on like that. And they have a term that their view of Sanskrit is diachronic. Whereas the view that we take is called synchronic. Synchronic means it's, you look at Chronos's time, and syn means all at one time. Diachronic means spread out across time. That Sanskrit is something that grows and develops. There's parallel changes between it and Old Persian and Zend and Avesta and but anyway they sit down. Whereas our view is simply, we treat you as one thing. There it is. There's Panini's grammar which describes it, and it's there. And our view is even more that we say it's original. Sanskrit means perfected. It's the language that's spoken on the heavenly planets. It comes down. We got it from outer space. You know, it comes down. So our view is by the academic point of view, to them, Indo-European philology is established to them as Krishna, Brahma, Narada, Vyas is established to us. This is their thing. So the pictures are very, very different. Now, I do not know philology. I haven't steeped my brain in this stuff. But I know this much. I know you can take the same facts and go in with a different perspective and look at them in a different way and see something else. That much I know. I will know when they took all these things and put together in one place that made sense, there are pieces that they left out. I know this because I know how intellectual things work. It happens everywhere else. I'm sure it happens here. There are pieces they can't explain. There's data they can't deal with. And they put it, because everything else fits without it, they set it aside. Anyway, someday we'll have to get into this. So, they have a similar picture that goes along with this picture of this language, at least for India, and that's the myth, I'm going to call it a myth, of the Aryan invasion. That, you know, these people also came down into India with their war god Indra leading them. And they encountered already a native people there, they called Dravidians, South Indians. And there were big fights between the Aryans and their enemies, many of whom were worshipping what they think was originally a Dravidian god named Shiva, who later got the name Shiva, and was gradually incorporated over the course of time into the Vedic pantheon, but it really doesn't fit. But they, you know, made some deal. And that the stories between the Suras and the Asuras are really tribal battles as the Aryans came down and originally worked their way, conquered their way through the Gangic Plain and beat up and subordinated all the people that are originally there, who became the Dasas or the Shudras. This is the story they tell. Something like this. There's the Indo-European invasion theory. And they found, you know, some of old cities in Harappa and Mohenjo-daro which had been dug up. And anyway, this is what they teach. You read, if you take any book in the history of India, this is what you hear. This is the dogma. Trouble is, it's all wrong. The trouble is, actually, is that if you even now start to attend historians of India in their sessions, you know, like at the American Academy of Religion or the AAS, you'll find that they're talking about that the Aryan invasion may not have taken place, because there's lots of evidence. The evidence for it is not there.
it sort of fits in and everything. But meanwhile, people have all done work. So everybody that's gone to college in the last 50 years believes in this, even if the people who are now the experts no longer believe in it. And it'll take another 20 years for the word to get out. Because the book you'll go, any high school kid goes to book, and he'll get from the library A.L. Basham, The Wonder That Was India. He'll get Morton Oviedo, The Indo-European Civilization. Then he'll find out about this stuff. And it'll be full of stuff that even the speculators no longer believe to be true. So this battle between the Suras and the Asuras, this was like a tribal scuffle that took place. The Asuras is us, the guys, the Suras, that's us, we're the good guys. And maybe Indra was a war king, you know, or Manu, or, you know, some of these guys, they're originally historical people. There's different ways of looking at it. Anyway, they had a battle on the bank of the Narmada River. And, you know, the other side had this giant named Vitra. Just like the Philistines, you know, they had Samson. When they fought the Jews, you know. Because, you know, the Philistines in the Bible, we always said the Philistines were the bad guys and the Jews were the good guys. But then when you go to college, you read about the Phoenicians, what great guys they were. And someday, one day, it finally connected in my mind, wow, the Philistines and the Phoenicians are the same people. You know, one guy, they're good guys. Anyway. Yeah. It's so funny, you know, how you never put them together. Anyway, you know, the story is that the Philistines had this giant. So anyway, they had giants, you know, and there was a squabble. So there was one guy who was bigger than the others, you know. So there was a fight. Now, over the course of years, sitting around campfires, telling the story, you know, how big and heavy everybody was, gradually it gets blown up into a big tale. And you get this whole story, you know. That's what they believe when they read this book. So you tell them that, no, this took place, you know, at the beginning of the Satya Yuga, and on another planet, you know. What do you mean, what other planet? Nobody's been to planets, you know. We've not gotten any further past the moon yet. These were scruffy people, you know. These were very little tribal groups wandering around, fighting each other. You know, you're talking about all this stuff. And these dates that we give, there were no human beings this long ago. You know, this battle took place 120 million years ago. And this, you know, we're not even in the same... there's no basis for discussion, practically. These dates that we give are so outrageous. According to so all we have to say is they're really, really, really wrong. That's ultimately all we can say, is they're really messed up. And you can see how they're messed up. You look at their presuppositions, you look how they start out, you look at what they already believe. They've already come in with a belief. Actually, the whole thing is part and parcel of a way of looking at the world that really grew up in the 19th century. It's fairly recent. Where somehow or other, in the 19th century or 18th century maybe, there began to be a big switch in the European way of looking at things. And but it is, one historian has described it as the temporalization of the chain of being. Everywhere you go, you see the notion of hierarchy. Hierarchy comes from two Greek words meaning holy order, hieros and arche. But at the top there's God, or a source of everything, who's somehow highest in being. He's more real than anything else, because he's eternal. And then there are gradations of existence all the way down. Celestial or heavenly gradations. There's orders of angels in the Christian story. There's hierarchies of beings. And you come down to the human beings, and there's also hierarchies. At the top is the Brahmin, then there's the king, then there's nobles, and so on down. Shudras, uncivilized people. Then there's animals. Animals is also hierarchy. The lion is the king of the beasts, you know. There's hierarchies. And it starts from the highest, which is the supreme source. And this hierarchy is vertical. So you see this notion of a chain of being, which was believed in, you know, in the poems of Alexander Pope, and you can still see this notion. But what happened in the 19th century, of which Darwin is an effect, not a cause, was this chain, this hierarchy, got temporalized. And you start from nothing historically, and somehow or other you evolve your way upward until you reach the end. From the lower comes the higher. From things of less value comes things of more value. From things that are primitive comes things that are more complex and developed. Human beings are evolving upwards. And then in the 19th century, there was the notion of within human society, there was what's called social Darwinism, that in a competition to survive and prevail in the marketplace of capitalism, the weak would die off and the better would propagate themselves. And so gradually in this way, the human race itself, there's a notion that we get from the 19th century, it's a recent notion, which is the idea of progress. When I was a kid, we used to watch TV and there was some commercial, it was a progress is our most important product. Who is that? General Electric or somebody? I forgot. Progress is our most important product. But actually the idea of progress is also a 19th century, that things are getting better and better and better and better. And this is what people still believe. They believe in progress. And most people who ISKCON devotee, people who follow the Vedas, we don't believe in progress. A lot of people don't believe in progress anymore. They think things are getting worse rather than getting better. That's what seems to be happening. In fact, that's what Prabhupada says. Everything that we that's labeled as getting better, he told us is getting worse. People look at the progress that's been made. Now any woman can have an abortion. Look, look at all the progress. I said, this is not progress. The quality of human beings is declining. We see it as what this progress is, advancement of Kali Yuga. And so on. But they've got this, so this is a myth. You see, this is the myth. You have a picture that you make, and you fit as many facts into it as possible, and the ones that don't fit, you set aside, you discard, you don't worry about them too much. So this is a myth. And you start with some inexplicable origin, and then from nothing or very little, everything gets derived. There's just the physics by which, gradually more complicated subatomic particles give rise to more complicated structures. And you're in the realm of chemistry. Then there's physics. Then there's chemical evolution, chemical reactions on the molecular level, molecules form. And then over those, suddenly there's this like little thing that happens. And you get life, primitive life, practically, nothing at all. And from the primitive life, more and more, until you get the human being finally emerges, out of the snuffling apes-like creatures, somewhere in Africa. There's these little 4 feet tall apes, they're suddenly, somehow become more like, and then, you go upwards, upwards, and then you get, human beings that are, modern, Homo sapiens. That's right, Homo sapiens, there's Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, but then there's finally Homo sapiens.
And then, you know, the idea is that Homo sapiens will again evolve more and more and more through progress and reach the stars, you know. That's why people want to go to space, just so they can say, you know, it's moving. See, in the 19th century, you had a large part of the world was still filled with Aboriginal people, so you could go and still beat up on them and say, this is progress. You know? So now what's happening, and we're still doing the thing of progress, like ripping down the Amazon's jungle, you know, which is what everybody was doing for the whole 19th century, was just exploiting resources and making colonies and, you know, enslaving other people and giving them civilization. I mean, you know, England was convinced that by ripping India off, it was doing a good deed by giving them civilization. People are convinced like this. You know, if you have a colony, a country from which you can take everything, or take all your raw materials, and you force them, that then it becomes your closed, non-competitive market. You know, progress. But now, you know, when you want to keep on doing progress, like ripping down the Amazon jungle and paving it over, and filling it up with wawas, people say, wait a minute, is this really... We need this jungle, you know. Actually, we should have jungle. People say, what do you mean we need a jungle? So, so it's the idea of progress has really hit a dead end. And the seminar rather, the space program doesn't seem to work anymore. You know, where everybody's supposed to be shooting off in space and sitting in a cocktail lounge on moon and looking at the Earth, you know. It's not happening. Nobody can figure out why. They put up this, you know, billion-dollar Hubble Space Telescope and it's all screwed up. Somehow the progress isn't going. You know, so people are stuck now. What do we do? Where's our progress? So, but that's the myth. This is the myth. You know, it's a myth. And we have our story, which is an entirely different story based on different data, different information. This is of a culture that's handed down from ancient times. What they see is in all these cultures, and not just Indo-European cultures too, is the whole story that some time ago there was another age, which the scholars call the age of myth. They call it the age of myth. You know, when human beings were primitive, then they believed, you know, the whole universe was animate. And there were people behind everything. And there were like demigods or higher beings that used to come and walk on earth and talk with us and so on. But we don't see them. Where are they? They're gone. Where are the leprechauns? Where are the elves? Where are the naiads and the dryads? You know, the Greeks kept saying they're naiads and dryads and all these, you know, every stream had its little... You see the same thing in the Mahabharata. Everywhere you go, there's a person. There's some little being there. You know. You go to the Jamuna River, and there's Jamuna. There she is. She comes out. There's Ganga. You know that they're there. Every place has. Where are they now? We don't see them. People had a real vivid imagination. They were more primitive and so on. That's what they think. What they can't think is that, like, there's just a whole dimension of people's experiences that has been shut down. That's what we say happened. Kali Yuga began, and it's like everybody had a chunk of their brain removed. And you can't see, and you can't experience what's actually there. That's our version. Anyway, I'll stop there. Any questions? Any comments? Yeah.
It was so thoroughly indoctrinated in the modern atheistic worldview that they can actually understand that if you don't accept that, you can very upset. Someone can actually realize, like a scholar or an intellectual person, actually realize that we just simply reject that, and they can be very upset.
That's right. You know, we had some, when these college classes came here, there was two graduate students that sat here through a Sunday feast lecture that Nagaraj gave. He was talking about when Ramachandra appeared.
And they met with me up in my office, and the first thing they said is, "You don't take this literally, do you?" And so I spent a half an hour explaining to them that I did, you know. They just went like that. They just couldn't act it. Because they were amazed that Nagaraj was talking about this stuff as though it were fact. Yeah, no, it's inconceivable to them. But, you know, that's one thing, though, that why, like, for example, the whole New Age, is they're ready to do this. They're ready to go back and look at, reassess history. The whole New Age movement, at least that this believes in common, that there was in the past some golden age. The idea is always there. It comes down to all sources that in the past there was a golden age, or that there are cycles beginning again and again and again. And people have believed this, serious people like W.B. Yeats, who's maybe the greatest poet of the 20th century, Irish poet. You know, he believed in this, the world's great age beginning new. That's Shelley, actually. You know, that this belief has been going on about cycles and yugas. But it's kind of had a sort of underground existence, you know. The official historians, they don't buy it. But it is, in fact, it's growing. People are becoming more used to it. I think we have to stop this time. Glory to the problem.